Shrink Wrap Radio number 317, Body Therapy and the Embedded Life with Dr. Stanley Kellerman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is longtime body work pioneer, Dr. Stanley Kellerman, and we'll be discussing his work on formative psychology and the embodied life. Stanley Kellerman, PhD, is the director of the Center for Energetic Studies in Berkeley, California, where he teaches the formative approach to human development. He received an honorary PhD from Saybrook University for his contributions to the field of body psychotherapy and humanistic psychology. He's also the founder and developer of Formative Psychology, the director of research at the Center of Form and Development in Zurich, Switzerland, and a visiting lecturer at the Spectrum School of Humanistic Psychology in London, England. He has authored the pioneering books Emotional Anatomy, Embodying Experience, Your Body Speaks Its Mind, Insults to Form, Living Your Dying, and Myth and the Body, in addition to numerous clinical books. Currently, he's writing a book on dreams and the body. Stanley Kellerman has been practicing and developing somatic therapy for over 35 years, and he's a pioneer in a study of the body and its connection to the sexual, emotional, psychological, and imaginative aspects of human experience. Through his writings and practice, he's developed a methodology and conceptual framework for the life of the body. Dr. Kellerman has been the director of the Center for Energetic Studies in Berkeley, California, since 1971, where he maintains a private and group practice and an active schedule of national and international professional programs. He's the honorary president and director for research at the Zurich School for Form and Movement and the Institute for Formative Psychology in Solingen, Germany, where he also teaches. He's the recipient of Lifetime Achievement Awards from the European Body Psychotherapy Association and the American Body Psychotherapy Association. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Stanley Kellerman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. Of course, I've known about your work for years. Particularly in the 70s, I had lots of students who were taking your workshops and working with you, and they were very excited about your work, and I was seeing your name at various conferences and so on. And back then, there was a kind of neo-Reichian revolution calling attention to the body, and the approach came to be called bioenergetics, and on the East Coast, the go-to guy was Alexander Lowen, and on the West Coast, it was Stanley Kellerman.
That's true.
Okay. You're not going to deny it.
No. Al Lowen was a good friend of mine. He was an original teacher of mine. Mm-hmm. We were friends until he died. We had regular telephone contact. I grew out of what he had to say, or I grew my own way.
Yes.
What he had to say. But we were friends for as long as he lived, and I still consider him a friend.
Yes, well, that's great. I found a lot of information about you that I didn't know on your website. For example, I discovered that your interest in the body started very early, first with athletics, and then with your training as a chiropractor.
Yes, that's true.
And did you ever practice chiropractic?
I had a very thriving practice. From about 1955 to approximately 1964, I had developed a very specialized technique for the reduction of stress. I had a very big time show business practice, and opera singers. It actually started with opera singers.
Oh, interesting. Fascinating.
Which I was able to, the guy who taught interact with me, actually to teach me something, Dr. William Herman, he was a medical doctor who won the first Caruso Scholarship for singing. And he understood singing, and he understood the tensions in the body as interfering with the singing pattern. And so he would send clients to me, and I would work with him back and forth, and we had a long interaction over years, which was very fruitful in understanding singing and speaking and the problems of stress that were related to it.
Well, that's fascinating. I can see how that helped to lay the groundwork for the places that you went. Clearly, you had a wide-ranging intelligence, as your subsequent career indicates. You weren't content to just stick with chiropractic, but went on to seek out many additional trainings. For example, you went on to study bioenergetics with Alexander Lowen. You already mentioned that. And then you went on to study at the Alfred Adler Institute.
Yes.
Yeah. How did that experience change your worldview?
Well, what it did, which one of the things that put me in a bigger frame, Adler dealt, first of all, with the social aspects of human interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an important concept for me. But more importantly, Adler wrote a very famous book in which he talked about organ inferiority and how. And by that he meant an organ that wasn't working, like your liver or some other organ, and which dominated your behavior and how you thought about the world, and that became the basis for inferiority feelings. And then the organism's will to power, which was a much more dynamic concept than the drive only for sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the organ inferiority became a very powerful understanding and tool. I spent almost 200 hours at the school. So it was that was fruitful to me. But within the same time, just to keep things in a thing, with Bill Herman and Al and the Adlerian Institute, Nina Bull, who was a fellow in Who's Who in Science and was a teacher in understanding attitude psychology, which really was the driving force that transformed the chiropractic education into a somatic education. And so there I was. Nina gave me a very powerful neurological background. She wrote several books, The Attitude Theory of Emotion and The Body and Its Mind, in which she showed the neural and muscular interaction was basically connected to patterns of behavior that were muscularly and neurally organized that represented the emotional organization of a person and how they were involved in behavior.
Well, that sounds like a really important milestone in the development of thinking about the body and psychology. Do you remember about what year it was that her book, The Body and Its Mind, came out?
Let's see. That could have been about 1960, 1961.
Okay, that's pretty early.
I met Nina. The book hadn't been out too long.
So, still,
I have it on my desk right now.
Yeah.
We'll take a look at it.
No, that's okay. Still not content to rest on your laurels, your inquisitive mind took you to Europe, where you studied Dasein analysis in Zurich,
right,
with Dr. Dori Gutscher, sure, in the school of Mehrd Boss.
Right.
I had not heard of her, but certainly I've heard of Mehrd Boss and Dasein analysis. How did that experience impact your thinking about the body?
Well, my trip to Europe was a very interesting, because what I became deeply interested in is what is the nature of somatic freedom? What is the nature of the life of the body in terms of being an organism that is trying to make its way into the world? I was very influenced by Darwin. And so I thought that somewhere the nature of soul was missing, what I thought was soul, at least in those days, from American psychology, as it was taught then. It wasn't in the Adlerian school, it wasn't in the school of analysis of the Freudian people, it wasn't in Al school. And it interested me, and Dasein analysis was very interesting to me in the way he put it forward as a part of the existential movement, which was very interesting to me. So I went to Europe to where I met with Carl Fried von Durkheim in Germany, and with Dory Gutscher, in the Dasein Analytic School, and then I became familiar with Boss himself, and talked about an existential view of how the body is in the world. That's a Heideggerian point of view. But I translated all that physically. How is the body in the world? How is the person as a body finding his way in the world? What are the essential ingredients for the organism forming its adult in the world? And I found that Coffey, who was a psychologist himself and a PhD in philosophy, and Dory Gutscher was a medical doctor and psychiatrist, provided a very powerful existential point of view. It was in Europe that I met Hillman, and we had some very nice discussions. And we continued some form of friendship back in the States when he left the Zurich Institute. But it wasn't in the Jungian world either, so that I realized I had to begin to understand what an embodied life was.
Yes, and speaking of the existential viewpoint that kind of became the basis for humanistic psychology, and you returned to the United States from Europe in 1967. You moved to California. You intern at the Esalen Institute in Group Dynamics, where you're exposed to humanistic psychology, which is the leading edge of psychology at that time. And there's an atmosphere of cultural revolution, you write, and you establish your own form of working bodily in your interaction with many leaders of the humanistic movement, for example, Carl Rogers, Fritz Perls, Virginia Satir, Alan Watts, and others, provided a forum for your ideas. And then you meet Joseph Campbell, whom I'm a big fan of, and began a 15-year association teaching an annual program in which the two of you develop connections between myth and the body.
Oh, yeah.
And these workshops evolved into annual programs taught by you in Berkeley and in Solingen, Germany, that connect dreams, body, and the formative process. So I didn't know any of that. What a rich and fascinating background.
Well, for me, it was, let's put it this way. I was not only forming a way of working, I was forming my own life. I was my own experiment in this.
Yeah.
And also developing a work which led me more and more to understand that really the heart of human misery in its general package was that there was an ignorance about how to meet the demands of a society for learning and educating and dealing with relationships that the organism could not do, or that it didn't know how to do it, or that it forgot how it did it in its childhood episodes. And I began to see that these were influenced by the mythology approach of Joe and what mythology was, and about the existential point of view, about how a person tries to be in the world, but they put the whole thing on a sort of innate intelligence that you just learn to do this as if you didn't participate in it. It happened by osmosis. Or they just completely misunderstood the nature of ritual, the nature of practice, the nature of how you use your body. You're always trying to correct something rather than for something.
Yeah, well, this really begins to lead us into your current work. And It also, knowing all of this about your background, helps me to understand better the papers that you've written, which struck me as very philosophical and even metaphysical in their tone. And so now I understand better how it is that you have come to move to a level of abstraction, even while talking about something as concrete as the body. So tell us about your work today in what you call formative psychology. And you make a distinction between a bodied life and an embodied life. And that sounds like kind of subtle. What are you getting at there?
Well, let me back up a little bit and come back to that, can I?
Okay, yeah.
The conversations and the workshops with Joe Campbell were extremely illuminating. Joe understood that the life of the body was at the heart of mythology, but he didn't quite know how to translate it. And so in the telling of the myth, which Joe was, he was the master of, and the presenting of certain symbols in his images that he showed on the screen, I translated all those things into biological events. For instance, we did a gigantic program on the nature of mythology, showing, and I showed all the signs that were related to embryology, how they were really talking about an embryological process like the snake. And the many-petaled clown was actually the spinal cord and the bonds and the pons and its relationship to the thalamus and the cortex. And then I made that translation. So once I understood the biological events as being the background for the experience of how we sort of articulated being in the world, I understood that the body is feeding itself back about its own experiences. And that most people, including Al Lowen, try to help people understand that we have a body and that psychology, including humanistic psychology, was in fact trying to connect people back to having their body and how their body influenced being in the world. And I began to realize that that was a very important first step. But having a body doesn't mean that you formed the body. It means that your life is formed by the body and by all the innate processes that we inherit, including our social way of imitating, like being a gentleman or a lady or whatever. And that nobody really understood that how you practice a behavior, like speaking, like writing, like learning to pay attention, like how not to argue or hit your sister or brother, that you practice this. And I began to see that what you practice, how you walk, how you write, how you try to teach yourself to speak, how you monitor your muscular reactions about being with your parents was the foundation of self-knowledge and forming a personal life. Forming a personal life was those acts that you practiced or those events that you tried to incorporate into how you act that gave you a personal life, and that was different than the body you inherited. It was the body that you shaped. And how you are shaping your own behavior is the embodied life, which is different than the body life. They're connected. But it says that how the organism uses itself transforms what we inherited, and that is the process of evolution. And that became a work of helping people try to form a life, try to disorganize and reorganize behavior, which has been bodily form into a shape that is much more applicable to being alive, being in relationship, and being intimate. So maybe as in the talk I gave in to the osteopath way back in 1906 or 7, I've forgotten now, maybe 5. I gave a talk to the life of the body and what it means to be embodied. And a question that kept coming up, could you tell us, these were osteopaths, why is it that when patients come to see us, they leave the office, they feel good, and then they come back and they say, well, I felt good for 3 days, but something happened, now I feel not so good anymore. What happened? Could you tell what happens? I said, you forget that any intervention requires that the person reinforce that intervention and not be passive to something that happens as if it will carry on as if it doesn't have to do anything. So you're sort of saying the body will heal itself and you don't have to do anything.
I think we all have this wish for the magic silver bullet where all we have to do is take a pill or go see a body worker or a therapist and that they'll fix it for us. But you put a lot of emphasis on volition.
I think it's a word that I've changed to voluntary effort. Effort. Because I wanted to take away from it. This is not a willful act. It is the development of voluntary muscular effort. How you learn to walk, hold yourself steady. The organism is, the child is practicing that. You see them practicing holding steady. They're correcting themselves. And then you realize they are efforting, and efforting is, in fact, a voluntary act which involves connective muscular tissue and cortical tissue. How we learn to walk, how we learn to steady ourselves, how we learn to walk like our fathers or walk like our mother is a voluntary act which makes a connection between the cortex, especially the frontal lobes, and muscular effort, making that link between efforting, experiencing, making neural maps or images, and then cognition are all linked. And that if you do something to a client, putting your hands on them, getting the tissue to relax, or whatever you do, or even having an insight to a conversation, how is that embodied? What does the person do to support that organismic state that turns insight or feeling into action? And that becomes, I think, the central issue of evolution and the central issue that every person has in their life. How do they make a transition from adolescent to adulthood, from being a full-grown adult to being an older adult? You have to practice behavior. Practicing behavior means making an effort that you can repeat and master, and as you repeat and make a masterful use of it, you create cortical stimulation and cortical dialogue. You link that to words and narrative, and then you have a body that you have made inside the body you've inherited, and you begin to have a sense of having power in the world.
You know, I think about a practice like Tai Chi, which I practice for several years, and is very slow, repetitive movements over time. And how might something like Tai Chi relate to what you're saying? Because it sounds like it might embody at least part of what you're talking about.
I'm not a master of understanding Tai Chi except in the most generalized way. But as far as I've understood, at least from the way I work, if you make a fist and open the fist, you see that it's sort of habitual. You just do it because there's the closing reflex. But opening the hand takes more effort than closing the hand. So you see that there's more effort in extending the fingers than in closing the hand. Then you realize that there's a process going on in which you are actually sequencing an action and altering the sequence of an action. And in doing that, you have to do small steps, increment steps to allow different muscular sequencing to happen so that you have an action of closing the fist that you can do slower and slower and slower until you realize that you have, that is closing the fist, an organized response. It's not simply closing the fist. It's that there's a contraction taking place in stages that is altering the joint surfaces. It's altering how the body balances itself and also signals learning a different order of sequencing. It's not producing a smooth muscle action like in Tai Chi, but a series of very differentiated small acts like playing the piano or stroking the violin, how you're using the fingers on the fret, how much effort it takes to learn that. To learn that muscular control that which allows you a very specific action with very specific intent that fits a style of how you are made to play something or to carry out an act. That's voluntary muscular effort that requires the act of attending, the act of differentiating a muscular action, the action of muscle and emotional feedback, and then the repetition until the act has a library of motor events that it can use in the same way that it would use verbal language. Mm-hmm. This is what the human enterprise is about. And I think that that's an unusual way of thinking about how to practice a behavior. So if you say to a person who's very anxious and he tells you or she tells you, you know, I'm always anxious, and you ask them to show you the pattern of anxiety. Now, anxiety is part of the startle reaction, which means the organism stops, freezes, the hands open up as a preparation to investigate or run or attack. That you see the hands open up, the neck freezes, the eyes open up, spreads, and the breath is held. And then you just say to the person, can you, with voluntary effort, make that pattern of anxiety, the starting pattern now, more intense, so then they can squeeze themselves more, make themselves stiffer to do that. And then you say to them, now, can you back off? Can you do it less? Don't relax. Do it less, just like you did it more.
Mm-hmm.
The person simply makes small little steps in reducing the tension pattern of alarm, which is the start of posture. And then they realize that they could affect the intensity of their anxiety. And then they realize, hey, wait a second, if I do it this way, I might not get rid of the anxiety, but I now can manage it. I don't have to be so anxious that I decorticalize myself and become a reflex animal. I could now say, I can do this, I could be less anxious. And what is it like to be less anxious facing an authority or my own excitement? So this now has very practical application in managing different forms of anxiety. And then we could take that into depression. I wrote an article for the U.S. Body Psychotherapy on the nature of depression being a series of motor acts from alarm to helplessness to getting ready to withdraw, to being defeated and collapsing, that there are four or five different bodily states, very identifiable, where somebody's gone from the stiffness of being fight-flight to the stiffness of being frozen and unable to do anything, to the shape and the body shape of being collapsed or defeated. And that those shapes can be addressed just like they did with the alarm pattern, to be less intense. And when they're less intense, you have a different state. I'm less depressed. I'm less defeated. I'm less confused. I can at least relate to something I don't understand rather than being overwhelmed by it. And that means you have a new shape, and you could practice coming back to that shape over and over again until you develop a behavior, a relationship to yourself and the other person.
When you talk about somatic shapes based on processes such as constriction, expansion, and you enumerate a bunch of processes, it sounds a bit like Reich's concept of character armor, but you seem to have elaborated on it, taking it further.
I don't think so. I think I'm closer to what Nina Bullitt has elaborated. He talked about tension, and tension states as sort of armoring states, which he came to being polite or being defined or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm linking him to inherited patterns of behavior. And they're listed, you know, like in one of the articles I talk about the stress continuum, so that anxiety is part and parcel of the alarm pattern. The alarm pattern is part and parcel of an invested growth pattern. It is a body shape. It is an inherited body shape to deal with situations in which the organism doesn't have an immediate response to. And it is otherwise a shape, is a whole muscular behavioral pattern that carries with it the readiness to act and all the accompanying feedback which we recognize as emotion or as a feeling. So it's different than what he meant by armoring. I'm saying the organism has a series of inherited behavioral shapes, and those behavioral shapes, whether they're going forward to hunt, to stalk, to look for a way of attacking another animal, or a way of retreating and going back and preparing to run or to run, these are inherited patterns, the same as to reach out, to bond, to hold on, to cling to the mother, so that you don't fall, to hold on to something so that you can hold your balance. These are behavioral shapes that are invoked in situations that call for a specific action or an action that doesn't have a specific response. It's different than what life is saying.
Is it fair to say that you believe then that somatic change leads to psycho-emotional change?
If you take somatic change now, you know, if you take, there's nothing that happens that isn't the body.
Mm-hmm.
You have, once you begin to understand that the body is a very complex anatomical organization that has an interactions with itself in generating behavior, so that, in my opinion, that how a person is motorically involved is the way that it thinks, the way that it is rehearsing to practice an act, is a way of generating the sensations that are the fuel for thinking and emoting. Then you understand that just like the person who plays the fiddle and is pressuring the strings on the fret with different intensities is in fact engaging in the basic language of the organism. Pressure, duration, intensity, sequence of movement. that become part and parcel of how words are formed and how language is organized. And you see that it's an act that is not only muscular, but it now is now invoking all the neural mechanisms and feedback of sensations that begin to form a language of images that accompanied it and sounds that accompanied it, and also remembered it. That is inherited memories and also memories that you have formed about how you act as part and parcel of an internal subjective dialogue which is accompanying the action.
I want to ask you a question which is probably perpetuating the dualism that you're wanting to break through. And the question is how you're feeling these days about psychotherapy through a body approach versus through a talk therapy approach. Is it an either or a both and?
Well, I would say to you, first of all, talking is fundamentally a muscular act. You cannot escape that. Talking involves how you breathe to agitate or oscillate the laryngeal muscles. You're sending up sound waves, and then sound waves that are sequenced in a particular way in which people understand muscular movements of the larynx as a form of communication. So talking and how you talk and how you use yourself is really important in how you conduct interactions with people who are seeking help. So to me, working physically requires also talking and how you talk. It's part and parcel of your social conversation and your internal conversation. You can't work with somebody bodily and not involve language. I think the split is artificial, or it's dramatized that you think language will cure everything. My big insight coming out of my chiropractic training was an understanding the fallacy of psychoanalysis, not that it's... When I say the fallacy, doesn't mean that what they did didn't work in some cases. That because you could disassemble and reorganize the way you use words and sequence how you're talking to yourself about something, did not mean that you disengaged from the motor pattern that was perpetuating how you were experiencing feeling, and that they had made a split between languaging and hoping that it would get back and disengage some of these motoric patterns which were at the basis of the person's discomfort. And I recognize, no, you can't do that. You have to make sure that that connection is happening. So then you see that the organism is not a dualism, but it's a very distinct and complex organizational wholeness that is always trying to maintain the different motor experiences in a singular pattern of action.
Yes, okay.
I want to say the approach, yes, I write in a way that it has a philosophical bent. Mm-hmm. I write in a way in which I am trying very, and I love doing it, to form a language of embodiment. I'm trying to, when I talk about organism, porosity, rigidity, motility, and density, I'm talking about the patterns of behavior and tissue states. I'm trying to create an embodied language because there is none. It doesn't exist out there. However, yeah. Search through the world of literature, mythology, psychodynamics, philosophy, it's not there. We have to create it, and I see it as a stage in the evolution of how the organism is relating to itself. So that clearly is one of my intentions. But the work is extremely practical. For example, in the way that I would ask the patient or a client to tell me their dream, so that they will tell me, say, a dream fragment. Or after our last conversation about how I was startled, I dreamt this and this and this, and there was, I saw this man, and this man seems to be trying to open the door. And I would then say, would you please imitate muscularly the way the person in your dream is using himself to try to open the door.
Mm-hmm.
And to make the pattern of all the different steps about how he reaches for the knob or bangs on the door, and in the person then trying to imitate an action that he now has an image of in his own brain, which has made this image. I have now linked image, cortex, muscular action, voluntary imitation. I have now created an interconnected event, muscular, emotional, vascular, cognitive event. And then the person realizes, hey, wait a second, I am now imitating, creating a muscular act with all the thoughts and associations of my dream. I have brought my dream back into the source of its origin, which is my body has dreamed it, my brain has dreamed it, and now I'm turning it into an action. I understand how I can influence my behavior and create a way of now not opening the door, but opening a conversation with another person.
What would guide your choice in choosing a bodily action in a dream that perhaps is long and has a lot of different kinds of interactions and symbols and so on in it?
Well, the first thing I say to people, just tell me what in your dream imagery attracts you. So that would be one step. Oh, I'm very excited about them opening the door.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would say, just choose one. Whether you like it or not, just choose one. Or then I would understand that this person has a pattern of which I would say, let's use the word density, which is a kind of a hunkering down, hibernating pattern in which the organism tries to mute its reactions and be sort of restrained about being in the world. He doesn't want to, or she doesn't want to be exposing themselves, they're very cautious in how they reach out. Then I may see and point out that, hey, you know, the door guy opening the door is a sort of an opposite of the way you're in the world. So let's see how you now would practice opening the door as a way to disengage or reorganize your hunkering down attitude. So I may use that approach.
Right. Now, I read that you're actually working on a book about dreams in the body, and I got very excited about that because dreams have been a long-standing interest of mine for many years. I taught a course at Sonoma State University called Myth, Dream, and Symbol. And, of course, I drew heavily on your friend Joseph Campbell's book, Hero with a Thousand Faces. I imagine in your book maybe you'll have some case examples. Might there be one that you could kind of take us through briefly?
Well, I just gave you one about this person opening the door. Do you have a specific one? Just tell me your dream, and I'll...
I don't have a dream off the top of my head. Let me just think here. I don't have a dream off the top of my head, and you did give us a good example. So rather than press you on that point,
let's take it this way. If I explain to a person, look, the situation you're in is calling for a change in the way you're handling the situation. And let's say that the way that I'm talking to you and the way you're talking to me, you explain to me and show me that you feel helpless. And let's make the pattern of helplessness more explicit.
Mm-hmm.
So then we do that as I just explained to you with the opening door. Then he may come back to me and say, you know, I had a dream. I had this dream. I was in a well, and I didn't know how to get out of the well. So then I would then say, wait a second. We just were talking about how you densified and made yourself very compressed. So now you have felt that. Now you have dreamed about that. So now let's organize how you are in the well. Show me, what is it like in the well? And then you'll see he'll press his body together and get a gripping hold in his hand. And then I say, do it a little more. And then he'll say to me, oh, my throat, I feel I'm strangling myself, and I feel panic that I won't be able to breathe, and I'm very confined. And then I would say, could you loosen the pattern of this squeezing? Could you undo it in small steps so you could get a sense that you don't have to squeeze so hard in a confining situation, whether that situation is you confining yourself or something in the environment? And then he does it less, or she does it less, and they get different senses of being able to be less confined, less confining. And then we talk about what is that like, and how will he use this pattern of being less confining or confining himself when he's at work, when he feels pressured, when he's in a sexual situation, when his children make a demand on him, and then he begins to use his experience and his internal cortical reality to alter his behavior and form a different way to use himself being in the world.
There was a way in which, in some ways, the example that you've just given reminded me of Gestalt therapy, but it seems to me that the difference is this sort of very careful and gradual attention to the patterns in the body.
Yes. Maybe I should put it this way. When we describe how we think or act, what is in our culture is think before you act, or feel and then act, or check your feeling so you don't be reactive. Action never is in the first place. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, action is always in the first place. You can't live without acting, whether it's involuntary or voluntary. You don't realize that the body is always in the preparation of maintaining a particular action pattern to keep itself alive, whether it's to turn over and sleep, whether it's to stand up, whether it's ready to brush your teeth. There's always a readiness to act. Mm-hmm. Thinking accompanies that. So I'm trying to get back to the original patterns of organized behavior, which is the foundation of the motoric sensory patterns of self-informing, of which the person is doing their primary and secondary cognitive involving themselves. What is the basis of their thinking?
Okay, that's really clear. I'm wondering, what's your view of the present state of affairs for the body therapy movement in general? I mean, you must be aware that there are other approaches out there, other people who...
For the body psychotherapy journal, on the difference, and you mentioned it, between the bodied life and the embodied life. I think I'm pointing out that they've made great strides in understanding that you have to have a bodied life, that the bodied life is important, and how it's brought into the arena of our daily life. But they don't quite understand yet how you form a bodied life, how you form a personal way of being in the world. And to that degree, they have fallen prey to mindfulness or to a spirituality which is disembodied. And I feel that if I have anything to say to them is that we have to think evolutionarily how the organism has created in a few hundred years a cultural organization that is transmitting behavior that can be both imitated and repeated that was not programmed by our genetic code, but allows the organism to do two things. One is to shape its environment, and then to shape its own body. And that this is an evolutionary event, and this is what we're living, and this is what is going on, and that we have to pay attention to this process.
And you said something about a few hundred years, so you're talking about, are you now sort of embedding this in terms of cultural evolution?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you think about how many years the cortex has been exploding in its ability to symbolize language and events and behavior, we are talking maybe 50,000 years. I'm going to just date it as Joe Campbell dated and some of the anthropologists are dating it to slightly before the caves of Lascaux, where you begin to see the first images that people not only portraying a reality that they see the animals, but leaving their handprints on the wall that tell you about authorship. And then you realize that in those years, there is an enormous evolution in how we should behave. And how we should behave, it was not programmed. It is transmitted culturally, and sometimes we don't know how to actually aid that. And that creates difficulties. You know, Marshak, the guy out of Harvard, wrote that famous book about the roots of writing, and he points out writing existed before any language. And the evidence is showing you carvings on ivory about what looks like the lunar cycle, which may be related to menses, before there's any language that we know about that was formalized to talk about it. So he tells you the act of writing is a physical act that took place before there was formalized language. And that's what I'm saying, that the physicality of behavior has generated the ability to create behavior.
I wonder if you have any reflections about this current moment that we're in, this sort of digital transformation of our lives.
Well, I know that it's happening, and I see that this is part and parcel of a different way of forming the behavior. Let me put it to you this way. This is just a generalization, David, that the human organism has gone from adapting to nature to some influence over nature, how it controls the environment or creates environments. And then this was this adaptation and then not adapting to environmental changes, but now creating environments which are more friendly for us, like cities, to how the organism now is relating to itself, how the organism now is talking about itself as an environment that has to be cultivated. So then that really means a sort of cortical complexity around muscular movements, because that's what's happening. The frontal cortex is rich in being able to resequence and make fine motor acts which change the organism's internal environment and its way of being in the world. And you could say that this digitalization that's appearing so strongly as a quick way of being able to influence your own life has two aspects. One, to grow an enriched cortical ability to influence the rest of the structure and to form a particular kind of human being, and to relieve the organism's limitation on available memory by creating an external memory, meaning first a book was an external memory, as stone tablets were, and now hard drives are, and so forth, so that there is more availability for the cortex to create behavior and make new memories with epigenetic evolution internally, so that the organism has a different way of relating to a world that it's creating inside itself and outside.
Okay, very interesting. Well, as we wind down, I wonder if there are any final points you wish to make, or something that my questions didn't give you a chance to express.
Well, I hope that I've not been too cryptic, and I hope that I've not been too philosophical, and I hope that I have been practical, that the life of an embodied life is the emerging truth about what human existence is about, and that we are in this stage of our life now in a gigantic revolution about what human values are, what human life is about, how humans can live, how they protect their internal environment. This is going on. This is a gigantic evolutionary step, in my opinion, and we are living it. And we are in it.
There's no question that we are in it. And yes. Dr. Stanley Kelman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure, and I hope we meet again.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Stanley Kelman and that you learned something about the frontier of bodywork. For myself, I really appreciated this opportunity to get to know Stan beyond his reputation and body of work. I feel like I got some sense of him as a person in our relatively brief contact, and I must say I like the person I experienced. As you heard, I'm quite impressed by his lifetime pursuit of knowledge, continually broadening his base for understanding our human organisms in our evolutionary context, our cultural context, and the social context of our current lives and relationships. I don't know if Stanley is acquainted with the work of Dr. Mark Solms on neuropsychoanalysis, and who was my guest on the podcast immediately prior to this one, but I think there is a real congruency between the latest findings on the brain and the ideas that Stanley was expressing here. Would you agree? If you'd like to find out more about Stanley Kelman, his upcoming workshops, and some of his articles, you can go to his website at www.centerpress.com. Let me extend a big welcome to any new listeners out there. I'm happy to welcome you to our listener community, and I hope you'll keep coming back for more, as so many have done. Thanks to John Eastman and Janice L. Taylor for being the latest listeners to sign up to make regular periodic donations through PayPal. Those ongoing donations are especially helpful. However, I also appreciate the one-time donations as well, and I'm also grateful to all of you out there who have helped to support this show in the past. And if you haven't done so yet, won't you please click on that big green donate button? I know most of you these days listen on portable devices and are not in front of your computer to go to the website. So make a note on your smartphone or whatever, reminding you to click on that big green donate button when you get home. You'll feel so good when you do, and I've got the whole field of positive psychology to back up that claim. The time is getting close for the two-day workshop on dreams, in Stockholm, Sweden that I'll be offering on Saturday and Sunday, September 8 and 9. Just a month away. I'm getting butterflies in my stomach already. And you can find full details on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. Just click on the Swedish flag icon in the right-hand sidebar on our site, and that will give you all the information you need to sign up. I'd really like to meet not only you Swedes, but also listeners from nearby European countries. Hey, Ryanair is really cheap, right? All you professionals, don't forget we've got more than 60 continuing education units that you can earn by just listening to these podcasts, and there are more on the way. At around $10 per unit, they're a real bargain. Just go to the store tab on our site for full details. And you might want to check out wisecounselpodcast.com. Although I'm no longer submitting new interviews to that site, I think my final two interviews that I never announced here are there. And I hope I didn't confuse you by that ill-constructed sentence. We do have a new transcript, thanks to Jeremy Devins. It's for Shrink Wrap Radio number 311, Synchronicity and the Interconnected Universe. Boy, that was a rich interview. You should grab that transcript, just for posterity's sake, if nothing else. I was recently contacted by longtime listener, fan, short story writer, and new podcaster, Cesar Torres, to be a guest on his show. He has a wide variety of guests and topics, but the thing that ties all the episodes together is that he asks each one what the strangest thing is that ever happened to them. We had a long and wide-ranging conversation. If you want to hear me talk about my life and views beyond what you've already heard here, I've put a link to that interview and to his podcast, which is named The Labyrinth, on our site. Just go to the In the Media tab on shrinkwrapradio.com, and it's the first item on that tab. And by the way, Cesar has also published a collection of his short stories, and you'll find a link to those on his site.
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Once again, we're running rather long, so I'll read just one recent email from our listener community, and an interesting one it is. It comes from Sonia. I think it's Sonia, or it could be Sanja, who writes, "Dear David, I discovered your podcast in April this year and have listened to maybe half of the episodes on Shrink Wrap Radio and some of the ones on Wise Counsel." Boy, that would be a lot in a relatively short period of time. She goes on to say, "I'm especially interested in the episodes that deal with consciousness and dreams, and am intrigued by the interesting and sometimes very nonlinear career paths that many of the people you interview seem to have taken, especially the Jungian analysts. The very first episode I listened to was the Ally Work interview with Jeffrey Raff, and I also particularly like the interviews with Ruben Nyman, Barry Krakow, and Daniel Siegel. In spite of Jeffrey Raff's references to alchemy, which is a concept I don't find very useful, I liked that first interview I listened to so much that I ended up buying his book and, based on his exercises, started writing for half an hour every morning." Wow. "I haven't encountered any allies yet, nor do I necessarily expect that I will. But if I remember any dreams, this journaling ends up being mostly a dream journal with my attempts at analyzing them. I had kept a dream journal before when I was trying to induce lucid dreams, but at the time never made any serious attempts at figuring out what the dreams mean at a deeper level. Somehow the more recent efforts at dream journaling have led to a significant improvement in my mood and energy throughout the day, so I'm still writing pretty much every morning. I guess trying to face your unconscious mind does have its payoffs. For this reason, I'm very interested in the dream group that you've been mentioning on recent episodes. I was wondering if there are any requirements for joining this group other than having an account on Google+. I am a neurobiologist with a background mostly in molecular and cellular biology, so I have no training in psychology, nor do I have any experience with interpreting other people's dreams. I'm a bit reluctant to provide any personal information to Google, which is why I haven't joined up yet. But if it were possible to join your dream group, I'd be willing to give up my internet privacy for this. Thank you. I think you mentioned that you'd have one on Sunday the 5th. That's August 5th. It's probably a bit late to sign up for this. I expect you have no shortage of interested listeners. But if you were to do this again, I'd be very interested in joining. This is getting kind of long. Thank you for providing all this interesting and helpful information. Keep up the great work. With best wishes, Sonia. Sonia, thank you for all that very interesting background information. I'm really glad to have you as a new listener to the show and appreciate all your enthusiasm for the kind of coverage that we've been doing here. About the dream group that we had, the Google Plus Hangout, which was to have happened last Sunday, August 5th, only one person actually showed up, Brandon, who's been a close ally and collaborator, and we did manage to share a couple of dreams, and we had a good time. I'm still figuring out Google Plus, and I guess you were following me, but what I've discovered is that it requires another step on my part, that I have to figure out who's following me, and then I have to make sure I've dragged them into my shrink wrap radio listener circle. So I probably will give the Google Hangout dream group another try at some point, but I think I'll wait until after the workshop that I'm going to be leading in Stockholm on September 8 and 9. And once I've got that under my belt, we'll come back to seeing what we can do in the online environment. But thanks a lot for trying. And so I think I'll wrap it up with that. I think you folks know how to get in touch with me by now, so I'll skip that portion. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Stanley Kellerman, for sharing his insights on body therapy and the embodied life. And my next interview will be with Harvard psychiatrist Dr. Nancy Rappaport, and we'll be speaking about how to understand and deal with especially challenging problem kids. Heads up, though, I may take an impromptu vacation with my daughter and her family to Hawaii. And if I do that, it will throw off my regular podcast schedule, and the next one might be about a week late. So that'll give us all a chance to take a deep breath and relax. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know. And just enough to make you dangerous.